if we kind of go back in time, this guy here, Rene Descartes, kind of important in terms of a lot of the approach to both studying behavior, in modern psychology, and also with respect to this the issue of non-human subjects, using them, what you can use them for. Descartes, amongst other things, producing Cartesian coordinates, XY axes, that was him, produced with respect to what's interesting to us, is what's called Cartesian dualism. Descartes, so the story goes, Descartes did a lot of interesting things. He was very interested in reflexes for a while. Story was that he was at the at Versailles, where there was what were called the Versailles Water Gardens, where you could like walk around these gardens and you'd step on like hidden plates, the flagstones and things like that, be pressure sensitive, and this would cause water to be pumped into sort of essentially a 17th century animatronics device, and like, you know, Poseidon, a statue of Poseidon would come out and raising a spear or something at you or something like that, or Venus would pop up in a spray of water and stuff like this. And these statues all worked and moved based on hydraulic pressures. And so Descartes started thinking about this in terms of the nervous system and thought that perhaps, you know, the nervous system worked in a very similar way. That and you got to sort of remember what was known in terms of medical physiology at the time. I mean, nerves, blood vessels were known to be hollow, transport of blood. From what they could tell from nerves, they sort of thought they were hollowish. They certainly seemed to have some sort of goopy fluid in them when you cut through in the cadavers. And they knew that in the brain, middle of the brain, there's these vesicles, fluid-filled vesicles. And so what Descartes started thinking was that in the brain, you've got this reservoir of fluid, and human brains had what we call a pineal gland, and he thought this was unique. Other studies of dissections of non-humans hadn't seemed to find a pineal gland in any other species. So he thought this was unique to humans. So he thought there was something special, and perhaps the pineal gland was involved in thought, conscious thought, and that what would happen is your brain would somehow direct this fluid to go out of the vesicles through the nerves and then would fill up the muscles. So if you wanted to lift your arm, you know, the fluid would go down, be pumped into the muscles, and in the same way these statues hydrostatically cause hydraulic lifting of a limb in that way. He was completely and totally wrong, but that's okay. It was a nice idea at the time, given what he had to work with. Anyways, so he gets very interested in reflexes and behavior in general. Now, here's where the dualism comes in. He divides things into what he calls the involuntary actions, or what we now call reflex actions, and voluntary actions. Now, involuntary reflex actions, Descartes was fairly sure, were caused by external stimuli. So in a book he wrote on this, there's a classic picture of schematic of a person reaching out and being burned by a hot fire, and it's causing the reflexive retraction of the limb. And so he said, right, so, you know, these involuntary actions, these are caused by these external stimuli. You experience pain or something else. This causes things to occur. What about the voluntary actions? Well, he says, this is due to these voluntary actions. These are the ones we now call probably conscious actions, under conscious control or cognitive control. These are what he said was controlled by the mind. Now, what exactly is the mind? Well, that's a little bit of a tricky philosophical issue back in the 17th century. Even today, you know, we talk about mind, but what do we really mean? You've also got to realize that Descartes had to contend with the Inquisition at this point. Of course, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. But anyone know Monty Python? Two people? Okay. He had to stick very close to official sort of Catholic Church doctrine on this. Now, whether Descartes really believed that only humans had a mind, which was basically equated with a soul, is unclear. But if he'd said anything else, he and the Inquisition would have been having a little conversation, it seems likely. Some historians have suggested that. So he makes this distinction. He says we've got the involuntary actions caused by by external stimuli, and we've got the voluntary actions controlled by the internal mind. Now, so we've got something like this. So we've got some sense organs, we've got a brain, and we've got some muscles. Remember those ideas, the fluid is in the brain that gets pumped through the nerves out to cause muscles to do stuff. So out in the physical world, a stimulus comes in, detected by the sense organs. Sense organs send this information onto the brain. The brain sends this off to the muscles, and then we get a response. So this would be this action would have been initiated through, if you will, an external system. This is what he called the involuntary system. This is what he says humans have involuntary actions. They can do involuntary actions, right? Reflexive responses. Humans can do that. Non-human animals can only do this. He said this is the only thing that non-human animals can do. They are, in essence, automatons. They're a little, he didn't have the word robot. The word robot was coined in the early 20th century by a playwright that wrote a play called R.U.R. Robotics, from like 1913 or something like that. I acted in it once. Interesting little play. But that's neither here nor there. The Matrix ripped off a bunch of stuff from it. But moving on. So he said, the non-human animals, they don't have a mind. They don't have a soul. All they can do is reflex actions. Nowadays, we'd say they're entirely hardwired. He wouldn't have said that, but that's our way of thinking about it. If you will, they're entirely genetically regulated. Okay. This is where it starts. This is where we get into the voluntary action. So, sense organ sends information to the brain. Now, here, with the voluntary, brain sends information to the pineal gland. Pineal gland is where the mind, or the soul, actually resides. This causes the pineal gland to be nudged. If you will, think of it like a little joystick being moved. This causes the fluid to go to the particular places and go out to the muscles, causing a response. So this whole system now is the voluntary system. Now, if you remember, our involuntary was just this. So the way Descartes structured this is God in his infinite Catholic-driven wisdom made the animals that had this stuff going on for them, and then he added a bit more to humans, gave them the mind, and the mind resides in the pineal gland, or the mind or the soul is the pineal gland, and this is where the voluntary control and the thought comes from. Now, again, whether he believed this or not, we don't know. A number of historians have suggested that he did not actually believe that there was a dichotomy between the non-human animals and the humans, but he kind of had to go, we're not sure. But this is what's called the Cartesian dualism. And for years and years and years, centuries, in fact, this became it was incredibly important in terms of study. So for years, even in the early years of very early years of psychology, it was like, well, you have to be, if you want to study things about humans, psychology, you have to study humans. Because humans are the only ones that have this kind of voluntary action. Oh, it's fine to study non-human animals for reflexes, things like classical conditioning, okay? Acquiring association between two stimuli that produces a reflexive response now to an initially neutral stimulus, that's okay. But if you want to study complex behavior, voluntary behavior, early thoughts was you would obviously have to only do this with humans. Now, as we get out of the 19th century into the 20th century, this becomes largely abandoned, certainly by, people like Tolman, for example. People say, you know, we can do an awful lot of stuff with rats here. You know, they seem to behave an awful lot like people on a lot of things, you know. So, very interesting. But this is a very, and in some ways this may have actually held back some of the development of psychology through 17th, 18th, 19th century, because it was perceived that there was this distinct split. And so if we were trying to understand human things, we could only work with humans. We couldn't make use of the non-humans. And, you know, you don't want to be too invasive with living humans, do vivisections or whatnot. I don't want to get into the morality of vivisection. I mean, the centuries were different, okay? I mean, 18th century ideals of vivisection, dissection of live organisms to try to understand how they worked, completely different morality. In the same way that people can talk about, was it ethical or moral for Watson to do what he did with little Albert? It's like, well, at the same time, you know, 20-something, you know, 8-year-old kids are also going down and working in coal mines. So they were different times. It's very difficult to translate the ethics and whatnot across. But still, the idea of vivisectioning humans to try to understand how the brain works, it's kind of a twitchy sort of thing there. So in some ways, this may actually have held back the development of study of more cognitive behavior in humans, because they didn't see what they could really use as a non-human model there. anyways, with respect to reflexes, and we will be talking a fair amount about reflexes through the first part of this course. I mean, classical conditioning is extremely involved in reflexes. Habituation and sensitization, reflexes, again, modification of reflexes. So in terms of the reflexes, Descartes here thought there was a positive correlation then between a stimulus and a response. So external stimulus leads to a response. Sekhanov, essentially a neurophysiologist, had some interesting things to say in the late 19th century about this. He sort of took the approach that very small stimuli could perhaps make a very large response. Now, in Descartes' case, he thought it was more or less correlational or proportional. So if you have a weak stimulus, you will get a weak response. If you have a strong stimulus, you will get a strong response. Sekhanov says, no, you could have cases where you can have very small stimuli that could lead to a very large response. And his take on this was that what happens is a stimulus releases a response from inhibition. Sekhanov took this sort of idea that like your reflexes were kind of like a spring-loaded trap that's just waiting to pop open. And finally, what happens? So your system is, if you will, under tension. There's a spring all ready to go, and all it takes is a stimulus to let it loose and have that reflexive response come out. So he says, what actually is happening is you actually have to be able to inhibit these responses. If you don't inhibit these responses, they're going to occur. Yeah. Yeah, could you have a very large stimulus and a small response? Sekhanov said yes, but he found didn't seem to happen very often. So he said, in theory, you should be able to. But his point was more that it doesn't necessarily have to be a positive correlation, a one-to-one sort of relationship here. He said in some cases, very seemingly minor stimuli can produce very large responses there. He did say that voluntary behavior could be elicited by extremely faint stimuli. So, and Sekhanov didn't really think that there was this distinction between the humans and the non-human animals as well. He said, you know, in cases here, you could have, if you're primed or actively cued or looking for something, you may be able to detect very, very faint things and then produce a response of whatever magnitude. Pavlov, also 19th century here, is saying that not all reflexes are going to be innate. Now, he's a physiologist, studies digestion, so he's dealing with these salivary and stomach secretions, reflexive responses in terms of food. But he treats these associations of neutral stimuli as reflexes as well, so conditional reflexes. He's not just calling it this because it's kind of a catchy name that parallels the unconditional reflexes. He really suggests that these conditional reflexes are just more reflexes, but they're learned reflexes. Okay, so he treats them as this very similar issue. So he says, not all reflexes are innate. Reflexes can be produced through learning. Now, our modern understanding of how reflexes work down to the neuronal level doesn't really match with that. So, I mean, in the modern, what we know modern times now about neurophysiology, an actual reflex arc is very different from what happens when you learn through classical conditioning. We're not actually growing a new reflex arc here. Something very different is actually happening. But this is the way that Pavlov treated it. So, this is the kind of influence that Cartesian thought had down over time. Now, I mentioned before that psychology came out of this intersection between philosophy and physiology. And so we've got a few sort of philosophical isms here to deal with. First off, hedonism. Hedonists, while we tend to think of hedonism as just, do everything that's fun and enjoyable, the actual philosophical approach to hedonism is a little bit different. The philosophic approach here says, with respect to the mind, is that the mind operates lawfully. So it's not just a random willy-nilly do whatever you want that seems to be fun and hedonistic in that sense, but it says hedonism argues that there is a lawful operation of the mind. We can make predictions about how the mind is going to function, what it will do. And, for example, Thomas Locke argued that the way this, a very simple sort of rule here that we could use, is to say that the mind operates, the law under which the mind operates is pursue pleasure, avoid pain. Now, again, this doesn't mean the mind's telling you to go to orgies every weekend or something like that. It's like, woo! Avoid S&M games, that sort of thing. No, I'm joking, but some people misinterpret it this way. So the mind is just out to have you have as much pleasurable stuff as possible. No, what he meant was, and I mean, if you look at, say, Thorndike's law of effect, it's the same thing. Appetitive outcomes will cause you to do that behavior. So if you do a behavior and you receive an appetitive outcome, you're more likely to do that behavior in the future. That's Thorndike's law of effect. If you receive an aversive outcome, you are less likely to do that behavior in the future. Okay. That's the same as this hedonism interpretation. Pursue pleasure, avoid pain. Make behavioral responses that lead to appetitive outcomes. Pursue the pleasure. If you're hungry, eat. Okay. Appetitive outcome? There you go. Avoid pain. Avoid aversive consequences. Right? So, there's nothing really, based on some sort of sensationalism about this here. But we see here, this kind of 18th century philosophical idea really then makes its way through down into modern operant conditioning principles here. So again, this philosophical approach shows up in modern psychology. Okay, two others, nativism and empiricism. Let's deal with the empiricism first, the empiricists. Sometimes called the British empiricists, this is a philosophical school of thought that said, you are born with nothing. Everything that you are is due to your experiences, hence the empiricism. Okay? So experiences, associations, this is what makes you what you are. They coined the ever-famous T-shirt phrase. Does anyone see this on T-shirts nowadays? No, probably not. A tabula rasa. 19th century was all the rage. People were, I am tabula rasa. Tabula rasa, Latin for blank slate. Basically a little chalkboard. Back before there was computers and iPods, right? You had to actually take notes with a little chalkboard called a slate. Okay, so you were born a blank slate. Now you're born a blank PDA. And as we go through, to use the metaphor, to butcher the metaphor, as you go through life, your PDA that you're born with is unformatted. You have to dock it and load the initial files. And then as you go through life, you add apps to your PDA. Some of them are free. Some of them you have to pay for, and so on and so on. Anyways, so that's the empiricism. He said, no, you don't have anything innate. Everything is learned. It's all about the experience. Contrast this, you've got the nativists, or the philosophical school of nativism. It has nothing to do with indigenous peoples. Okay, what they're saying is you have native attributes. Some attributes are, if you like, innate. So you are born with certain things like certain reflexes, certain behavioral responses, certain predispositions. You may acquire other ones. They may activate at different points during your life, or you may lose some. Grasping reflexes that babies have, that's lost after they get a bit older. You're not stuck with all these, puberty various responses show up that weren't there before. But they said, you got learning too. The nativists weren't saying it's only about being hardwired. So, you've got some stuff that you're born with, some innate capacity, and then there's also learning. And the learning, of course, can also modify some of these innate processes. So these are some of the philosophical ideas that are percolating around from the 18th century on and feeding into what will eventually become psychology. Now, one of the very important things, I mean, this is something that, say, the nativists and the British empiricists kind of argued about, was this issue of association. How does one develop association? What's important in these associations? I mean, for the empiricists, they were certain that everything was due to associations. Everything was due to learning. The nativists said, well, some of it's due to associations. They at least agreed that learning through association was important. Okay, what do we mean by this? We don't necessarily, a lot of people don't teach associationism anymore in psychology, although it's extremely important in both sort of the historical approach to the field and actually really in terms of the learning field, understanding some of the theories and principles is really comes down to this associationist interpretation. So the first guy that really proposed, or at least wrote down, I mean, probably Og, the caveman from 76,000 years ago came up with it. Hey, I think I've made an association between liking mastodons and, whatever. But he didn't write it down. So Aristotle wrote down a bunch of the good stuff. Aristotle said, look, there's three things that are particularly important in terms of memory, of generating memories and maintaining memories and whatnot. He says, contiguity, similarity, and contrast. If you got two ideas, if they are presented to you in a contiguous manner that is close together in either space or time, you are more likely to learn them. If the two ideas are similar in their form, you are more likely to be able to associate them together. He said, and if there are two things that are very much in contrast and opposition to each other, you are also more likely able to learn these as well. Scientific, good, strong, amazing scientific evidence for contiguity. We will see that again and again as we go through the rest of the course. Good scientific evidence for the role of similarity between stimuli. There is not so much good evidence for the role of contrast. Contrary to the sort of little game, I'll say a word and you say whatever comes into your mind. Cat, dog, right? Those seem kind of like opposites, but I mean, are cats and dogs really opposites? I mean, they're both furry quadrupeds that have been domesticated. In fact, they actually are probably more similar than different. Yeah. Anyways, day, night, well, both times of day, I suppose. I guess they're somewhat opposites. But there's not a lot of good evidence, aside from these sort of, little naming games, that in terms of trying to learn stimuli is actually made that much easier by having them being contrasting systems. They're much easier to learn if they're similar things. Okay, so at least contiguity though, and similarity are quite important and have been supported. So these go back to Aristotle, back to the Greeks. 18th century, a guy called Thomas Brown developed, added a few more. So Aristotle's are called the primary rules for association, and then the secondary rules come from Tom Brown here. Now, don't get me wrong, Brown was no scientist. He was a philosopher. He really just sort of mostly thought about stuff. Sometimes asked people questions about things, but really, he wasn't doing anything in the way of empirical research on this. So, but then, the nativists and the British empiricists were just philosophers, really. Yeah, okay. Let's turn that off in future, please. Okay, so some of the secondary ideas here. Or at least come up with something. It's like, Dr. Snyder, you're great. Dr. Snyder, you're great, as opposed to just a horn. I know, it's not going to happen, so that's okay. Length of exposure. So how long are you exposed to these two ideas? The longer you're exposed to them, the more likely you're going to form an association. It's like, okay, so you probably don't need to be an experimental researcher, figure that one out. I mean, just thinking about it, it's like, okay, fine, that works pretty well. Vividness. We might call this the stimulus intensity. Now, the easier it is to detect, the more apparent the ideas or the stimuli or the things are, the greater the salience, the more likely you are to be able to associate them together. The frequency, the number of times they're paired together. And the more often you do something, the more likely you are to learn it. Okay. Constitutional differences. Just said, look, some people just are going to be better at learning certain things than others. No idea why. Just their constitution. Just something about their way their brains or their body work. Some people are just better at learning certain things, making certain associations than others. Emotional state. In certain emotional states, it may be harder to form certain associations.
All right.
Health. If you're healthy, you'll probably be able to learn better. You'll be able to make association. You know, if you're on your deathbed, you're probably not going to be making any new associations there. I mean, really, why bother at that point? Prior habits. I said, you know, some people can probably train themselves to be better at making associations. In other words, you can learn better ways to, I guess, learn. Okay? So if you practice things, you know, people that practice crosswords, do crosswords a lot, are probably better at a lot of other linguistic issues. Freedom from strong associations with other stimuli. Well, you know, think about something like blocking from classical conditioning. If we've already associated stimulus CS1 with the US, then we try to bring in a second conditional stimulus as a compound stimulus, we don't learn much about the second one. Why? Because we've already got this very strong association between CS1 and the US. Okay, that actually fits there very nicely. So the secondary, Thomas Brown's secondary rules of association, again, even though he wasn't doing any empirical research on this to back this up or support this, actually these do fit very nicely with modern learning, learning and behavioral psychology. It's good evidence for all of these being significant. All right, so the principles of associationism then really deal with the idea that the way it drives is issues of sensations and what we call memories. Sensations were due to experiences, according to this sort of interpretation. Memories then, memories of the ideas. Okay? Nowadays we call these mental representations. Okay, we're so far beyond the 18th century, right? Or a couple of centuries on from that. But nowadays we talk about, I mean, you take a cognitive psychology course, right? They'll talk about mental representations of things, right? And your mental representation may not be exactly the same as the actual thing. So, I mean, I've got a water bottle here, or iced tea bottle, as it turns out. Somewhere in my brain, I've got a mental representation of what my little water bottle looks like here. It's red. It's shiny. My mental representation probably doesn't... Oh, I just noticed there's chips off down here. You know, if I was just thinking about it, I hadn't thought there was a little chip down there. So, you know, my mental representation isn't exactly the same as the real thing. I've never actually picked it up and looked at the bottom of it, but, you know, all the red's been rubbed off down there for some reason. Didn't notice that. So my mental representation was not completely accurate, but that's okay. It's some sort of memory. It's at least part of the memory. Yeah. Oh no! Memories are the ideas, or we in their terminology they talk about ideas and experiences. Nowadays we'll talk about things like sensations and memory. Sorry, the para. I'm sorry. I did not explain that very well, did I? No, I'm sorry. The 18th century associationist philosophers would talk about things like experiences and ideas. Nowadays, we tend more to talk about sensations and memory and mental representations. But this would be the parallel. So even in today, in modern psychology, we still use the same. We've changed the words a little bit. Sorry, I should have made this a little more clear here. Lecturing now for about 5 hours. We still use the same concepts, even though we've given them slightly different names. So the idea is we start with things like simple sensations, and these would lead to simple ideas. And the simple sensations would be these external things, in the same way that sort of Descartes talked about things coming in externally through the sense organs. Here's the same idea as well. Simple sensations are the things that are external to us. They somehow cross into us through our perceptual systems, auditory, visual, tactile, whatever, and then they generate a simple idea. Now, the associationist approach to this was that there's sort of a one-to-one correspondence between a simple sensation and a simple idea. Each simple sensation produces somewhere, somehow, in our nervous system, a simple idea. Simple ideas, then, can be combined together to form complex ideas. So a complex idea is two or more simple ideas that have somehow been linked together. And finally, complex ideas, two or more complex ideas, can be linked together to form duplex ideas. It's kind of like, you know, you've got two or more complex ideas living side by side together in a duplex idea housing system. Okay, it's actually not like that at all. So one-to-one between the simple sensation to the simple idea, and then simple ideas combined to make complex ideas combined to make duplex ideas. And there's a hierarchy to this, if you will. You've probably already figured this out. So here's all our simple sensations. You're being bombarded with them. They make it through your perceptual system and get encoded somehow. The philosophers were rather vague about this, as it turns out. Get encoded as simple ideas. These simple ideas then combine in various weird and wacky ways to make complex ideas, and then our complex ideas can be combined to form a duplex idea. Okay, so that's the general approach, the general idea to this. So it's a very hierarchical system. You say, well, okay, that's all very, very nice, but so what? Well, we'll get to some of the so what. I'll give you some examples. I'll give you some examples of that actually perhaps working in the nervous system in a little bit here. This guy, fuzzy chin and all, Ebbinghaus. So I mentioned in 1772, Wilhelm Wundt. Did I mention that in this class, Wilhelm Wundt? I can't remember. It was my former class. Sorry. Long day. 1772, Wilhelm Wundt opens the first psychology laboratory and does things like introspectionism and some sensory perceptions and things like that. Independent of any psychological laboratory is this guy, Herbert Ebbinghaus. In the 1880s, he's actually like a clerk or something. I can't remember exactly what he did for a job, but nothing to do with psychology. He'd never been trained in psychology. I mean, hardly anybody had been trained in psychology at this point. But he just gets interested in some of this stuff. And so he starts conducting his own experiments on this, on essentially the psychology of association, of ideas here, of memory. In essence, Ebbinghaus is the first cognitive psychologist. But he's not even a psychologist at all. This is where cognitive psychology comes from. And so he just starts doing stuff on memory. An interesting guy, fascinating guy. Published a book on this all by himself. Very, very interesting fellow. He only had one subject, him, because, you know, he's just kind of doing it for a hobby, just for kicks to see what he can do with this. So what he does is he invents a whole bunch of nonsense syllables. Now, he actually was doing this in German, not English, but I'm not sure. I don't think Zog, Path, or Taub are German words, but maybe they are. In any event, he came up with nonsense syllables. These would be consonant, vowel, consonant, but he picked things that wouldn't actually make any word. So, like, in English, D-O-G, consonant, vowel, consonant, but it's actually a word. So, can't use that. So, everything had to be a nonsensical sound. And then what do you do is you just make randomized list of these, and he'd read the list through, and he'd see how many times he'd have to read it before he could get perfect recitation from memory. And then he'd do things like he'd see how long it would take for him to forget. So, you know, he'd wait an hour and then come back and see how many of the words he could remember, and he'd calculate this up, and he'd call this the savings, you know, the savings of memory, what has been saved there. So, interesting guy. Some very significant findings here. Length list. So the longer the list of words, the harder it was to learn them, right? Okay, no surprise there, right? Makes sense. Repetition. The more times he would read through a list, the longer he could remember it. Okay, so the longer he could remember this. Now, what's very interesting is he discovered what's called overlearning. So he'd read through until he had the list perfect, okay? So he could recall it perfectly from memory. And, you know, you could just stop there. But then if he went through and kept reading through the list another, I don't know, half a dozen or a dozen times, it's called overlearning. He's already got it perfect, but he does more learning about it. He finds out that he can remember this even longer. The effects of forgetting are reduced. They're slowed. So even after he's apparently learned it perfectly, his recitation is perfect, no mistakes, you go, well, isn't that as much as you can possibly learn? You've learned it perfectly. What more could you learn? Well, you're learning something because he keeps going through it and it lasts longer. And we, of course, see this as well in things like classical conditioning and operant conditioning as well. The effects of time. There's a little graph on this. The longer he would wait after having perfect recitation before he would try again to recite the list, the more he would forget, or the less he would have in terms of his savings. But it wasn't a linear effect. So we find here that proportionally he loses the most in the earliest time frame. So after only waiting 20 minutes, he's lost almost 30% here of his list. By comparison, a month later, he's still got about a quarter of it. Right? So, 20 minutes, 1 hour, 8.8 hours, 1 day, he loses almost 75% of his list within the first day. But then over the next, 30 days, he only loses another, maybe 8%. Okay, so some very interesting things there. And this, forgetting curves. This is essentially what a forgetting curve looks like. A forgetting curve or a learning curve, they're essentially just different names sort of for the same kind of effect there. Contiguity. Interestingly enough, he found that it was easier. So if he learns his nonsense syllables, syllables 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, there, he finds that if he picks anyone, so like 4, gets, recall the fourth syllable in the list, it's easier to get the fifth syllable, to say the fifth syllable next, than it is to say to go from 4 to 6 or something later. So contiguity, the words that are closer together in the sequence are more easily learned. So this supports the idea of contiguity from associationism. Now, what's very intriguing here is he discovered what's called backward he played around with what's called backward association. So look at it this way. The degree of contiguity between word 4 and 5 is the same, it's one degree of separation, if you will, as between word 4 and 3. If he learns the list from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, it is easier, if given the fourth word, the fourth syllable, to recall the fifth than if given the fourth to recall the third. Even though they're both only separated, the fourth from the fifth is one degree of separation there, the fourth from the third is one degree. It's a backwards, right? He learned the list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. So 4 to 5 is a forwards association. Going from 4, having to back up to 3, that's harder. Okay, so even though they've got, contiguity, the way we typically talk about contiguity is things that are close together are going to be more likely to be learned. It's going to be easier to learn them. Well, 4 is as close to 3 as it is to the 5th, but it's easier to do this in the sequence that you learned it. So it's not just how close together these are. It's the ordering that also is important here. So some very interesting, very, very interesting work by Ebbinghaus. And again, he's doing this with absolutely no support whatsoever. Just read some stuff and started conducting some very nice studies. You don't have to have a huge lab to do very good science. He's really the founder of modern cognitive psychology. So where did this all go? So what happened with Ebbinghaus, the associationist, and how does this fit into later learning theory? Ebbinghaus's work and the associationist ideas with respect to thought processes and the nature of human knowledge, this feeds into cognitive psychology. This really is a lot of what goes into the cognitive psychology approach here. The empirical approach that Ebbinghaus brought to things. It's like, let's actually go, let's just not sit around in the coffee houses of London and Paris and go, well, I think perhaps that associations are important. Yes, yes, that's very good. Perhaps length of time is significant. Yes, it could be. I see that as well. Oh, more coffee over here. Thank you. Right. Instead of just philosophizing about things, Ebbinghaus said, I'm going to actually test it. I'm going to do something empirical. Okay. And so that kind of approach, that is like, well, why don't we just stop talking about it and actually try something out? That is massively important for the early comparative psychologists. People like, even though they didn't call themselves comparative psychologists at the time, but I mean people like Pavlov, people like Thorndike. This becomes massively important. They knew of, knew of Ebbinghaus's work. This, like, bring this experimentation into it. Don't just think about it. Actually test it. But not to say that the comparative not to say the cognitive psychologists weren't doing empirical testing as well. They were, but they take more of this sort of, what's the nature of the mind and the memory. Comparative psychologists are less concerned about that and more interested in the behaviors and how we can use this empirical approach to understand behavioral systems. Okay, so moving beyond the philosophy here. associationist principles show up in physiology as well. So late 19th century and early 20th century, physiology, neurophysiology as well, starts to benefit. We start seeing examples of the associationist philosophical concepts in here. Now, as I said, philosophy and physiology together, then that leads to psychology. So we're just going to talk a little bit here about some examples from the nervous system structural organization. So we'll look at some very simple physiological research on what we call simple sensations. Our nervous system. Nervous systems are essentially binary. Okay, neurons operate in a binary system. They're either transmitting a signal or they aren't. Okay, so they're either on or they're off. This applies to our retina, part of our central nervous system there. In the retina, we've got rods. Cells are called rods, which detect light and dark, and cones for color. Okay, basic, like, I don't know, what is this, like grade 7 kind of science stuff here? Yeah? And in that sense, then, this fits very well with our simple sensations, right? So, simple sensation comes in, particle of light comes in, bam, smacks into a rod, there's your simple idea, right? That rod then sends the signal, that's one-to-one, okay? So, simple sensation, simple idea, it's then propagates off down your optic nerve, ends up in your occipital lobe someplace, and there your brain does some stuff with it. We'll just call it stuff at this point. You don't want to get too mired down with that nitty-gritty technical neuropsychology, mumbo-jumbo, okay? Just something magical happens. Let's leave it at that, okay? So, yeah, it's just a big magical system in your head, okay? Somebody's spinning in their grave as I'm talking here. But this is a very nice example. So, I mean, you say, well, what does the philosophy really have to do with our physical systems? Right? Well, there may be something to this. Sensation comes in. Our nervous system, our perceptual, sensory perceptual nervous system, breaks these down into very small core elements. Right? We could talk about this in terms of your auditory system as well. Your canal, how individual neurons are activating with different frequencies. Yeah. Right. So in the sort of model, every simple sensation equates with a simple idea. You're saying that, yeah, we can only attend to a certain amount. Yeah, that's okay. Then, I mean, some of these simple sensations just kind of don't get processed. They bounce off. We don't pick them up or whatnot. In and of itself, that's not really a deal breaker for the parallel here. But yes, you're quite right. We can't attend to everything or process everything. Signal does get lost. We do lose. Probably not. We certainly lose things as we process through levels. But no, not everything is necessarily going to be processed or detected there. How about complex ideas? Well, let's just stick with our visual system here. Let's step up to the visual cortex here. So we get some complex images that our visual cortex processes, and this comes through an additive or a summation of information type of process. Anyone read Hubel and Wiesel's like classic 67? It's like where they've got like cats and things strapped into chairs staring at the wall, and they're, like, projecting little dots of light there. And, like, everyone talks about it in, like, intro psych, but nobody actually ever reads the paper anymore. It's like, isn't there just a YouTube video on it or something? That everybody's doing? Oh, okay. Anyways, so Hubel and Wiesel, this classic study that nobody reads anymore, discovered these simple cells. They're sticking electrodes into parts of the visual cortex of critters, and finding that specific cells in the visual cortex only respond to certain types of shapes. You think, I don't know, it's like there's a shape over there in the wall. Shouldn't all the cells in the visual cortex? No. We've got an electrode into this particular cell. We show a dot. We move a dot around the wall. Nothing. You know, we move a bar of light, you know, a little line around the wall. Hey, cell activates. Turn that single bar into like an intersecting corner, and nothing. Cell doesn't activate, but a different cell does. Okay, so let's get into our visual cortex. Now we're not just dealing with this sort of one-to-one simple thing. We've got something that's much more complicated. Here, our simple the information from each rod and cone is being summed into shapes. So we can, if you want, sort of visualize this. So with respect to our simple shapes here, we might have things like this, you know, very simple sort of bars or dots or lines or things like that. Complex retinal and then visual cortex shapes would be where we start combining these simple sorts of things into geometrics of various types. Okay, again, this is a very, very simple sort of example here of this, but you can use this and you can draw the parallels back to these associationist concepts there. Now, we're almost done. Actually, we're going to be done a bit early here for the day, but just as I said, we're not going to spend a lot of this course dealing with the particulars of neurophysiology or whatnot, but here's at least just a few little basic things we should all be on the same page with. Your friend, the neuron. It's a cell, right? Yes, yes it is. It's a special kind of cell. It's specifically involved in communication and information. It's got a soma, or a cell body. You all have bodies too. Aren't they special? A nucleus in the middle, that's where all your genetic regulation material is. We got some dendrites. This is sort of your, you know, if you were doing, ever do Pictionary? And it's like, you know, you have to draw some shape, you know. You draw something like this, everyone's going to go, neuron. Okay, I know not all neurons look like this, but I mean, come on, this is the stereotypic neuron. It's like, there you go, neuron. There's your axon terminal. Yay! There we go. I know, they come in different forms, but that's what everyone knows. And so it's really structures evolve to deal with really one thing, communication. Information in, information out. So incoming signal, and comes to the dendrites, picked up from the dendrites, so neurotransmitters. Electrical signal gets sent down to the down the neuron, down the axon to the axon terminal, and then back to chemical, crosses over to the next neuron in sequence, and off it goes. Spared no expense producing this animation. So there we go: chemical, electrical, and chemical. So neurons work in this way: with chemical and electrical transmission. The electrical stuff is what we call action potentials. So imagine this is the sort of blue donut in there is actually a cross-section through an axon, and we've got a little tiny microvoltmeter here with a couple of electrodes, and so we're going to just graph our change, the little delta triangle down there below, delta Vm. Delta just means change in, so change in our membrane potential. And so we start out here. We've got zero. Our electrodes are out in our saline bath, nothing. We stab one of them into the axon. You've got to be very careful stabbing with this because otherwise you go straight through and that doesn't work well. And once we do this, we find out that our axon is sitting there at negative 60 millivolts. And so it's already got a negatively charged potential. And this is what's used for our action potentials, obviously. So the action potential propagates down the length of our axon and sends the information to the axon terminal. So our action potentials are all or none. They're electrical. If you don't cross threshold, nothing happens. Okay. So you got to get at least enough stimulation there of the neuron. to cross a threshold there. Once that happens, you achieve an action potential, and you just can't stop. It's going to run the length of the axon, and then it'll drop back down. The neuron will reproduce its roughly negative 60 resting state, negative 60 millivolts of resting state, and goes back to that. So, just mentioning briefly here, synapses. It's our point of communication. We're going to talk a little bit about some synaptic stuff next class when we get into some habituation effects. I'm just mentioning a little bit of this here. So synapses, these are the points of communication between neurons. We talk about our presynaptic neuron, our postsynaptic neuron, and the space between them is the synaptic cleft. Okay, so that's actually the intercellular space there. The chemicals that move from one neuron to the other we call neurotransmitters, and we can have either excitatory or inhibitory neurotransmitters. And that's really it. I'm sorry, I feel like I've robbed you of a half hour here of teaching, but I was trying to do this very quickly last night. So we'll have more in the future. Okay, I don't know if you have time to go by the bookstore here before they... I don't know if you've done it before, but maybe you can duck in before they lock the doors down if you want to grab texts, otherwise tomorrow. If anyone didn't get a syllabus, I've still got some up here at the front. Otherwise, I will see y'all next week. Tuesday, there we go.